Warden threw a party in the county jail. Prison band was there, and they began to wail. The band was jumping, and the joint began to swing. You oughta heard those knocked-out jailbirds sing. The king stands with his legs apart, his blue eyes blazing, the bell-bottoms of his white jumpsuit shaking. Rhinestones glitter and flash in the overhead spotlights. A sheaf of blue-black hair falls across his forehead. The mic is near his mouth, but not so near Myra cannot see the pouty curl of his upper lip. She can see everything. She is in the first row. And suddenly, as the rhythm section blasts off, he is holding a hand out, holding it out to her, the way Bruce Springsteen, who will never be the king in a million years, no matter how hard he tries, holds his hand out to that girl in his Dancing in the Dark video. For a moment, she's too stunned to do anything, too stunned to move, and then hands from behind push her forward, and his hand has closed over her wrist. His hand is pulling her up on stage. She can smell him, a mixture of sweat, English leather, and hot, clean flesh. A bare moment later, Myra Evans is in Elvis Presley's arms. The satin of his jumpsuit is slick under her hands. The arms around her are muscular. That face, his face, the face of the king, is inches from hers. He is dancing with her. They are a couple. Myra Josephine Evans from Castle Rock, Maine, and Elvis Aaron Presley from Memphis, Tennessee. They dirty dance their way across a wide stage in front of 4,000 screaming fans as the Jordanaires chant that funky old 50s refrain, "Let's rock, everybody, let's rock." His hips move in against hers. She can feel the coiled tension at the center of him nudging against her belly. Then he twirls her. Her skirt flares out flat, showing her legs all the way to the lace of her Victoria's Secret panties. Her hand spins inside his like an axle inside a hub, and then he is drawing her to him again, and his hand slides down the small of her back to the swell of her buttocks, cupping her tightly to him. For a moment, she looks down, and there, beyond and below the glare of the footlights, she sees Cora Rusk staring up. Cora's face is baleful with hate and green with envy. Then Elvis turns her head toward him and speaks in that syrupy Mid-South drawl, "Ain't we supposed to be looking at each other, honey?" Before she can reply, his full lips are on hers. The smell of him and the feel of him fill the world. Then, suddenly, his tongue is in her mouth. The king of rock and roll is French kissing her in front of Cora and the whole damned world. He draws her tight against him again as the horns kick in with a syncopated shriek, and she feels the ecstatic heat begin to uncoil in her loins. Oh, it has never been like this, not even down at Castle Lake with Ace Merrill all those years ago. She wants to scream, but his tongue is buried in her mouth, and she can only claw into his smooth satin back, pumping her hips as the horns thunder into My Way. Mr. Gaunt sat in one of the plush chairs, watching Myra Evans with clinical detachment as her orgasm ripped through her. She was shaking like a woman experiencing a total neural breakdown, the picture of Elvis clutched tightly in her hands, eyes closed, bosom heaving, legs tightening, loosening, tightening, loosening. Her hair had lost its beauty shop curl and lay against her head in a not-too-charming helmet. Her double chins ran with sweat, much as Elvis's own had done as he gyrated across the stage during his last few concerts. "Ooh," Myra said, shaking like a bowl of jelly on a place. "Ooh, ooh, my God! Ooh, my God! Oh!" Mr. Gaunt idly tweezed the crease of his dark slacks between his thumb and forefinger, shook it out to its former razor sharpness, then leaned forward and snatched the picture from Myra's hands. Her eyes, full of dismay, flew open at once. She grabbed for the picture, but it was already out of her reach. She started to get up. "Sit down," Mr. Gaunt said. Myra remained where she was, as if she had been turned to stone during the act of rising. "If you ever want to see this picture again, Myra, sit down." She sat, staring at him in dumb agony. Large patches of sweat were creeping out from under her arms and along the sides of her breasts. "Please," she said. The word came out in a croak so dusty that it was like a puff of wind in the desert. She held her hands out. "Name me a price," Gaunt invited. She thought. Her eyes rolled in her sweaty face. Her Adam's apple went up and down. $40, she cried. He laughed and shook his head. $50. Ridiculous. You must not want this picture very badly, Myra.
I do.
Tears began to seep from the corners of her eyes. They ran down her cheeks, mixing with the sweat there.
I do.
All right, he said. You want it. I accept the fact that you want it. But do you need it, Myra? Do you really need it?
$60. That's all I've got. That's every red cent.
Myra, do I look like a child to you?
No.
I think I must. I'm an old man, older than you would believe. I've aged very well, if I do say so myself. But I really think I must look like a child to you. A child who will believe a woman who lives in a brand new duplex less than 3 blocks from Castleview has only $60 to her name.
You don't understand. My husband.
Mr. Gaunt rose, still holding the picture. The smiling man who had stood aside to grant her admittance was no longer in this room. You didn't have an appointment, Myra, did you?
No. I saw you out of the goodness of my heart. But now I'm afraid I'll have to ask you to leave. $70. $70.
You insult my intelligence. Please go. Myra fell on her knees before him. She was weeping in hoarse, panicky sobs. She clutched his calves as she groveled before him.
Please. Please, Mr. Gaunt. I have to have that picture. I have to. It does. You wouldn't believe what it does.
Mr. Gaunt looked at the picture of Elvis, and a momentary moue of distaste crossed his face. I don't think I'd want to know, he said. It looked extremely sweaty.
But if it was more than $70, I'd have to write a check. Chuck would know. He'd want to know what I spent it for. And if I told him, he'd...
That, Mr. Gaunt said, is not my problem. I am a shopkeeper, not a marriage counselor. He was looking down at her, speaking to the top of her sweaty head. I'm sure that someone else... Mrs. Rusk, for instance, will be able to afford this rather unique likeness of the late Mr. Presley. At the mention of Cora, Myra's head snapped up. Her eyes were sunken, glittering points in deep brown sockets. Her teeth were revealed in a snarl. She looked in that instant quite insane.
You'd sell it to her? She hissed.
I believe in free trade, Mr. Gaunt said. It's what made this country great. I really wish you'd let go of me, Myra. Your hands are positively running with sweat. I'm going to have these pants dry cleaned, and even then I'm not sure.
$80!
I'll sell it to you for exactly twice that, Mr. Gaunt said. $160. He grinned, revealing his large, crooked teeth. And Myra, your personal check is good with me. She uttered a howl of despair.
I can't. Chuck will kill me.
Maybe, Mr. Gaunt said, but you would be dying for a hunka-hunka burning love, would you not?
$100, Myra whined, grabbing his calves again as he tried to step away from her. Please, $100.
$140, Gaunt countered. It's as low as I can go. It is my final offer.
All right, Myra panted. All right, that's all right. I'll pay it.
And you'll have to throw in a blowjob, of course, Gaunt said, grinning down at her. She looked up at him, her mouth a perfect O.
What did you say?
She whispered.
Blow me, he shouted down at her. Fellate me. Open that gorgeous, metal-filled mouth of yours and gobble my crank. Oh, my God,
Myra moaned. As you wish, Mr. Gaunt said, beginning to turn away. She grabbed him before he could leave her. A moment later, her shaking hands were scrabbling at his fly. He let her scrabble for a few moments, his face amused, and then he slapped her hands away. Forget it, he said. Oral sex gives me amnesia.
What?
Never mind, Myra. He tossed her the picture. She flailed her hands at it, caught it somehow, and clutched it to her bosom. There is one other thing, however.
What?
She hissed at him. Do you know the man who tends the bar on the other side of the tin bridge? She was beginning to shake her head, her eyes filling with alarm again, and then realized who he must mean. Henry Beaufort? Yes. I believe he also owns the establishment, which is called the Mellow Tiger. A rather interesting name. Well, I don't know him, but I know who he is, I guess. She had never been in the Mellow Tiger in her life, but she knew as well as anyone who owned and ran the place. Yes, him. I want you to play a little trick on Mr. Beaufort. What kind of trick? Gaunt reached down, grasped one of Myra's sweat-slimy hands, and helped her to her feet. That, he said, is something we can talk about while you write your check, Myra. He smiled then, and all his charm flooded back into his face. His brown eyes sparkled and danced. And by the way, would you like your picture gift-wrapped? Alan slid into a booth in Nan's luncheonette across from Polly and saw at once that the pain was still bad. Bad enough for her to have taken a Percodan in the afternoon, which was rare. He knew it even before she opened her mouth. It was something in the eyes, a sort of shine. He had come to know it, but not to like it. He didn't think he would ever like it. He wondered, not for the first time, if she was addicted to the stuff yet. In Polly's case, he supposed that addiction was just another side effect, something to be expected, noted, and then sublimated to the main problem, which was, simply put, the fact that she was living with pain he probably couldn't even comprehend. His voice showed none of this as he asked, "How's it going, pretty lady?" She smiled. "Well, it's been an interesting day." "Very interesting," as that guy used to say on Laugh In. "You're not old enough to remember that." "I am so. Alan, who's that?" He turned in the direction of her gaze, just in time to spot a woman with a rectangular package cradled in her arms drift past Nan's wide, plate-glass window. Her eyes were fixed straight ahead, and a man coming the other way had to jig rapidly out of her way to avoid a collision. Alan flicked rapidly through the huge file of names and faces he kept in his head and came up with what Norris, who was deeply in love with police language, would undoubtedly have called a partial. Evans, Mabel or Mavis or something like that. Her husband's Chuck Evans. "She looks like she just smoked some very good Panamanian red," Polly said. "I envy her." Nan Roberts herself came over to wait on them. She was one of William Rose's Baptist Christian soldiers, and today she wore a small yellow button above her left breast. It was the third one Alan had seen this afternoon, and he guessed he would see a great many more in the weeks ahead. It showed a slot machine inside a black circle with a red diagonal line drawn through it. There were no words on the button. It made the wearer's feelings about casino night perfectly clear without them. Nan was a middle-aged woman with a huge bosom and a sweetly pretty face that made you think of Mom and apple pie. The apple pie at Nan's was, as Alan and all his deputies knew, very good, too, especially with a large scoop of vanilla ice cream melting on top. It was easy to take Nan at face value. But a good many business people, realtors for the most part, had discovered that doing so was a bad idea. Behind the sweet face, there was a clicking computer of a mind, and beneath the motherly swell of bosom, there was a pile of account books where the heart should have been. Nan owned a very large chunk of Castle Rock, including at least 5 of the business buildings on Main Street. And now that Pop Merrill was in the ground, Alan suspected she was probably the wealthiest person in town. She reminded him of a whorehouse madam he had once arrested in Utica. The woman had offered him a bribe, and when he turned that down, she had tried very earnestly to knock his brains out with a birdcage. The tenant, a scrofulous parrot who sometimes said, "I fucked your mama, Frank," in a morose and thoughtful voice, had still been in the cage at the time. Sometimes, when Alan saw the vertical frown line between Nan Roberts's eyes deepen down, he felt she would be perfectly capable of doing the same thing. And he found it perfectly natural that Nan, who did little these days but sit at the cash register, would come over to serve the county sheriff herself. It was the personal touch that means so much. "Hello, Alan," she said. "I haven't seen you in a dog's age. Where you been?" "Here and there," he said. "I get around, Nan." "Well, don't forget your old friends while you're doing it. she said, giving him her shining, motherly smile. You had to spend quite a while around Nan, Alan reflected, before you started to notice how rarely that smile made it all the way to her eyes. Come and see us once in a while. And lo, here I be, Alan said. Nan pealed laughter so loud and lusty that the men at the counter, loggers for the most part, craned briefly around. And later, Alan thought, they'll tell their friends that they saw Nan Roberts and the sheriff yucking it up together, best of friends. Coffee, Alan? Please. How about some pie to go with that? Homemade, apples from McSherry's orchard over in Sweden, picked yesterday. At least she didn't try to tell us she picked them herself, Alan thought. No thanks. Sure? What about you, Polly? Polly shook her head. Nan went to get the coffee. You don't like her much, do you? Polly asked him in a low voice. He considered this a little surprised. Likes and dislikes had not really entered his thoughts. Nan? She's all right. It's just that I like to know who people really are, if I can, and what they really want. That's too damn hard, he said, laughing. I'll settle for knowing what they're up to. She smiled. He loved to make her smile, and said, We'll turn you into a Yankee philosopher yet, Alan Pangborn. He touched the back of her gloved hand and smiled back. Nan returned with a cup of black coffee in a thick white mug and left at once. One thing you can say for her, Alan thought, she knows when the amenities have been performed and the flesh has been pressed to a sufficiency. It wasn't something everyone with Nan's interests and ambitions did know. Now, Alan said, sipping his coffee, spill the tale of your very interesting day. She told him about how she and Rosalie Drake had seen Nettie Cobb that morning, how Nettie had agonized in front of needful things, and how she had finally summoned up enough courage to go in. That's wonderful, he said, and meant it. Yes. But that's not all. When she came out, she'd bought something. I've never seen her so cheerful and so buoyant as she was today. That's it, buoyant. You know how sallow she usually is? Alan nodded. Well, she had roses in her cheeks, and her hair was sort of mussed, and she actually laughed a few times. Are you sure business was all they were doing? He asked and rolled his eyes. Don't be silly. She made as if to slap his hand. Something he knew she would never do, not even in jest, not with her hands. Anyway, she waited outside until you'd left. I knew she would. And then she came in and showed us what she bought. You know that little collection of carnival glass she has? Nope. There are a few things in this town which have escaped my notice, believe it or not. She has half a dozen pieces. Most of them came to her from her mother. She told me once that there used to be more, but some of them got broken. Anyway, she loves the few things she has, and he sold her the most gorgeous carnival glass lampshade I've seen in years. At first glance, I thought it was Tiffany. Of course it isn't. Couldn't be. Nettie could never afford a piece of real Tiffany glass, but it's awfully good. How much did she pay? I didn't ask her, but I'll bet whatever sock she keeps her mad money in is flat this afternoon. He frowned a little. Are you sure she didn't get hornswoggled? Pretty sure. Nettie may be vague about some things, but she knows her carnival glass. She said it was a bargain, and that means it probably was. It's made her so happy, Alan. Well, that's great. Just the ticket. Pardon? That was the name of a shop in Utica, he said, a long time ago. I was just a kid. Just the ticket. And did it have your ticket? She teased. I don't know. I never went in. Well, she said, apparently our Mr. Gaunt thinks he might have mine. What do you mean? Nettie got my cake box, and there was a note inside it, from Mr. Gaunt. She pushed her handbag across the table to him. Take a look. I don't feel up to the clasp this afternoon. He ignored the handbag for a moment. How bad is it, Polly? Bad, she said simply. It's been worse, but I'm not going to lie to you. It's never been much worse. All this week, since the weather changed. Are you going to see Dr. Van Allen? She sighed. Not yet. I'm due for a respite. Every time it gets bad like this, it lets up just when I feel like I'm going to go crazy any minute. At least, it always has. I suppose that one of these times, the respite just won't come. If it's not better by Monday, I'll go see him, but all he can do is write prescriptions. I don't want to be a junkie if I can help it, Alan. But enough, she said softly. Enough for now, okay? Okay, he said a little unwillingly. Look at the note. It's very sweet and sort of cute. He undid the clasp of her handbag and saw a slim envelope lying on top of her billfold. He took it out. The paper had a rich, creamy feel. Written across the front, in a hand so perfectly old-fashioned it looked like something from an antique diary, was Miss Polly Chalmers. "That style is called copperplate," she said, amused. "I think they stopped teaching it not long after the age of the dinosaurs." He took a single sheet of decalage stationery from the envelope. Printed across the top was "Needful Things, Castle Rock, Maine, Leland Gaunt, Proprietor." The handwriting here was not as formally fancy as that on the envelope, but both it and the language itself still had a pleasingly old-fashioned quality. "Dear Polly, thank you once again for the devil's food cake. It is my favorite, and it was delicious. I also want to thank you for your kindness and thoughtfulness. I suppose you knew how nervous I must be on my opening day, and in the off-season as well. I have an item, not yet in stock, but coming with a number of other things via air freight, which I believe might interest you a great deal. I don't want to say more. I'd rather you viewed it yourself. It's actually not much more than a knick-knack, but I thought of it almost the moment you left, and over the years I've rarely been wrong in my intuitions. I expect it to come in either Friday or Saturday. If you have a chance, why not stop in Sunday afternoon? I'll be in all day cataloging stock and would be delighted to show it to you. I don't want to say more just now. The item either will or will not explain itself. At least let me repay your kindness with a cup of tea. I hope Nettie enjoys her new lampshade. She is a very dear lady, and it seemed to please her very much. Yours sincerely, Leland Gaunt." "Mysterious," Alan said, folding the note back into the envelope and putting the envelope back in her purse. "Are you going to check it out, as we say in the police biz?" "With a build-up like that, and after seeing Nettie's lampshade, how could I refuse? Yes, I think I'll drop by, if my hands feel better. Want to come, Alan? Maybe he'll have something for you, too." "Maybe. But maybe I'll just stick with the Patriots. They're bound to win one eventually." "You look tired, Alan. Dark circles under the eyes." "It's been one of those days. It started with me just barely keeping the head selectman and one of my deputies from beating each other to a bloody pulp in the little boys' room." She leaned forward, concerned. "What are you talking about?" He told her about the dust-up between Keaton and Norris Ridgwick, finishing with how odd Keaton had seemed. His use of that word persecution had kept recurring to him at odd moments all that day. When he finished, Polly was quiet for a long time. "So," he asked her finally, "what do you think?" "I was thinking that it's still going to be a lot of years before you know everything about Castle Rock that you need to know. That probably goes for me, too. I was away a long time, and I don't like to talk about where I was or what became of my little problem. And I think there are a lot of people in town who don't trust me. But you pick things up, Alan, and you remember things. When I came back to the Rock, do you know what it felt like?" He shook his head, interested. Polly was not a woman to dwell on the past, even with him. "It was like tuning into a soap opera you've fallen out of the habit of watching. Even if you haven't watched it in a couple of years, you recognize the people and their problems at once, because they never really change. Watching a show like that again is like slipping into a comfortable old pair of shoes." "What are you saying?" "That there's a lot of soap opera history here that you haven't caught up on yet. Did you know that Danforth Keaton's uncle was in Juniper Hill at the same time Nettie was?" "No." She nodded. "Around the age of 40, he started to have mental problems. My mother used to say Bill Keaton was a schizophrenic. I don't know if that's the proper term or just the one Mom heard most often on TV, but there sure as hell was something wrong with him. I remember seeing him grab people on the street and start to hector them on one thing or another. The national debt, how John Kennedy was a communist, I don't know what all else. I was only a little girl. It frightened me, though, Alan. I knew that." "Well, of course it did." "Or sometimes he'd walk along the street with his head down, talking to himself in a voice that was loud and muttery at the same time. My mother told me I was never to speak to him when he was behaving like that, not even if we were on our way to church, and he was, too. Finally, he tried to shoot his wife, or so I heard, but you know how long-time gossip distorts things. Maybe all he did was wave his service pistol at her. Whatever he did, it was enough to get him carted off to county jail. There was some sort of competency hearing, and when it was over, they parked him at Juniper Hill." "Is he still there?" "Dead now. His state of mind degenerated pretty fast once they had him institutionalized. He was catatonic when he finally went, or so I've heard." "Jesus." But that's not all. Ronnie Keaton, Danforth's father and Bill Keaton's brother, spent 4 years in the mental wing at the VA hospital in Togus during the mid-70s. Now he's in a nursing home, Alzheimer's, and there was a great aunt or a cousin, I'm not sure which, who killed herself in the 50s after some sort of scandal. Now, I'm not sure what it was, but I heard once she liked the ladies a little better than she liked the men. It runs in the family? Is that what you're saying? No, she said. There's no moral to this, no theme. I know a little town history you don't, that's all, the kind they don't recount during the town common speech-making on the 4th of July. I'm just passing it on. Drawing conclusions is a job for the police. She said this last so primly that Alan laughed a little, but he felt uneasy just the same. Did insanity run in families? He had been taught in high school psychology that the idea was an old wives' tale. Years later, at Albany Police Academy, a lecturer had said it was true, or could be at least in certain cases, that some mental diseases could be traced through family trees as clearly as physical traits like blue eyes and double-jointedness. One of the examples he'd used had been alcoholism. Had he said something about schizophrenia as well? Alan couldn't remember. His academy days had been a good many years ago. I guess I'd better start asking around about Buster, Alan said heavily. I'll tell you, Polly, the idea that Castle Rock's head selectman could be turning into a human hand grenade does not exactly make my day. Of course not, and it's probably not the case. I just thought you ought to know. People around here will answer questions, if you know which questions to ask. If you don't, they'll cheerfully watch you stumble around in great big circles and never say a word. Alan grinned. It was the truth. You haven't heard it all yet, Polly. After Buster left, I had a visit from the Reverend Willie.
Shh,
Polly said, so fiercely that Alan was startled to silence. She looked around, seemed to decide no one had been eavesdropping on their conversation, and turned back to Alan again. Sometimes I despair of you, Alan. If you don't learn some discretion, you're apt to get swept out at the polls 2 years from now, and you'll stand there with a big, puzzled grin on your face and say, "What happened?" You have to be careful. If Danforth Keaton's a hand grenade, that man's a rocket launcher. He leaned closer to her and said, "He's not a rocket launcher. A self-righteous, pompous little prick is what he is." "Casino night?" He nodded. She put her hands over his. "Poor baby. And it looks like such a sleepy little town from the outside, doesn't it?" "Usually it is." "Did he go away mad?" "Oh, yeah," Alan said. "This was my second conversation with the good reverend about the legality of casino night. I expect to have several more before the Catholics finally do the damn thing and get it over with." "He is a self-righteous little prick, isn't he?" she asked in an even lower voice. Her face was serious, but her eyes were sparkling. "Yes. Now there's the buttons. They are a new wrinkle."
"Buttons?"
"Slot machines with lines drawn through them instead of smiley faces. Nan's wearing one. I wonder whose idea that was."
"Probably Don Hemphill. He's not only a good Baptist, he's on the Republican State Committee. Don knows a thing or three about campaigning, but I bet he's finding out that it's a lot harder to swing public opinion where religion is involved." She stroked his hands. "Take it easy, Alan. Be patient. Wait. That's most of what life in the Rock is about. Taking it easy, being patient, and waiting for the occasional stink to blow over, yeah?"
He smiled at her, turned his hands over, and grasped hers, but gently, oh so gently. "Yeah," he said. "Want some company tonight, pretty lady?"
"Oh, Alan, I don't know."
"No slap and tickle," he assured her. "I'll make a fire, we'll sit in front of it, and you can pull a few more bodies out of the town closet for my amusement."
Polly smiled wanly. "I think you've gotten a look at all the bodies I know about over the last 6 or 7 months, Alan, including mine own. If you want to further your Castle Rock education, you ought to make friends either with old Lenny Partridge or with her." She nodded toward Nan, then lowered her voice a trifle.
"The difference between Lenny and Nan," she said, "is that Lenny is content to know things. Nan Roberts likes to use what she knows."
"Meaning?"
"Meaning the lady didn't pay fair market value for all the property she owns," Polly said. Alan looked at her thoughtfully. He had never seen Polly in a mood quite like this one, introspective, talkative, and depressed all at the same time. He wondered for the first time since becoming her friend and then her lover if he was listening to Polly Chalmers or the drugs.
I think tonight would be a good night to stay away, she said with sudden decision. I'm not good company when I feel like I do now. I can see that in your face. Polly, that's not true. I'm going to go home and take a long, hot bath. I'm not going to drink any more coffee. I'm going to unplug the phone, go to bed early, and the chances are that when I wake up tomorrow, I'll feel like a new woman. Then maybe we can, you know, no slap, a lot of tickle. I worry about you, he said. Her hands moved gently, delicately in his. I know, she said. It does no good, but I appreciate it, Alan. More than you know. Hugh Priest slowed as he passed the Mellow Tiger on his way home from the Castle Rock Motor Pool, then sped up again. He drove home, parked his Buick in the driveway, and went inside. His place had two rooms, the one where he slept and the one where he did everything else. A chipped formica table, covered with aluminum frozen dinner trays, cigarette butts had been crushed in congealing gravy in most of them, stood in the center of this latter room. He went to the open closet, stood on tiptoe, and felt along the top shelf. For a moment, he thought the foxtail was gone, that somebody had come in and stolen it, and panic ignited a ball of heat in his belly. Then his hand encountered that silky softness, and he let out his breath in a long sigh. He had spent most of the day thinking about the foxtail, thinking about how he was going to tie it to the Buick's antenna, thinking about how it would look, fluttering cheerfully up there. He had almost tied it on that morning, but it had still been raining then, and he didn't like the idea of the dampness turning it into a soggy fur rope that just hung there like a carcass. Now he took it back outside, absently kicking an empty juice can out of his way as he went, stroking the rich fur through his fingers. God, it felt good. He entered the garage, which had been too full of junk to admit his car since 1984 or so, and found a sturdy piece of wire after some hunting about. He had made up his mind. First, he would wire the foxtail to the antenna, then he would have some supper, and afterward he would finally drive over to South Paris. A.A. met at the American Legion Hall there at 7 o'clock. Maybe it was too late to start a new life, but it wasn't too late to find out for sure, one way or another. He made a sturdy little slip loop in the wire and fastened it around the thick end of the brush. He started to wrap the other end of the wire around the antenna, but his fingers, which had moved with rapid surety at first, began to slow down. He felt his confidence slipping away, and, filling the hole it left behind, doubt began to seep in. He saw himself parking in the American Legion parking lot, and that was okay. He saw himself going into the meeting, and that was okay, too. But then he saw some little kid, like the asshole who had stepped out in front of his truck the other day, walking past the Legion Hall while he was inside, saying his name was Hugh P. and he was powerless over alcohol. Something catches the kid's eye, a flash of bright orange in the blue-white glare thrown by the arc sodiums which light the parking lot. The kid approaches his Buick and examines the foxtail, first touching, then stroking. He looks around, sees no one, and yanks on the foxtail, breaking the wire. Hugh saw this kid going down to the local video game arcade and telling one of his buddies, "Hey, look what I hawked out of the Legion parking lot. Not bad, huh?" Hugh felt a frustrated anger creep into his chest, as if this were not simply speculation, but something which had already happened. He stroked the foxtail, then looked around in the growing gloom of 5 o'clock, as if he expected to see a crowd of light-fingered kids gathering already on the far side of Castle Hill Road, just waiting for him to go back inside and stuff a couple of Hungry Man dinners into the oven so they could take his foxtail. No, it was better not to go. Kids had no respect these days. Kids would steal anything just for the joy of stealing it. Keep it for a day or two, then lose interest and toss it into a ditch or a vacant lot. The picture, and it was a very clear picture, almost a vision, of his lovely brush lying abandoned in a trashy gully, growing sodden in the rain, losing its color amid the Big Mac boxes and discarded beer cans, filled Hugh with a feeling of angry agony. It would be crazy to take a risk like that. He untwisted the wire, which held the tail to the antenna, took the brush into the house again, and put it back on the high shelf in the closet. This time he closed the closet door, but it wouldn't latch tightly. Have to get a lock for that, he thought. Kids will break in any place. There's no respect for authority these days. None at all. He went to the refrigerator, got a can of beer, looked at it for a moment, then put it back. A beer, even 4 or 5 beers, wouldn't do much to put him back on an even keel, not the way he felt tonight. He opened one of the lower cupboards, pawed past the assortment of rummage sale pots and pans stacked there, and found the half-full bottle of black velvet he kept for emergencies. He filled a jelly glass to the halfway mark, considered it for a moment, then filled it all the way to the top. He took a swallow or two, felt the heat explode in his belly, and filled the glass again. He started to feel a little better, a little more relaxed. He looked toward the closet and smiled. It was safe up there, and would be safer as soon as he got a good, strong Krieg paddle lock at the Western Auto and put it on. Safe. It was good when you had something you really wanted and needed, but it was even better when that thing was safe. That was the best of all. Then the smile faded a little. Is that what you bought it for? To keep it on a high shelf behind a locked door? He drank again, slowly. All right, he thought. Maybe that's not so good, but it's better than losing it to some light-fingered kid. After all, he said aloud, it's not 1955 anymore. This is modern days. He nodded for emphasis. Still, the thought lingered. What good was the foxtail doing in there? What good for him, or anyone else? But 2 or 3 drinks took care of that thought. 2 or 3 drinks made putting the foxtail back seem like the most reasonable, rational decision in the world. He decided to put off dinner. Such a sensible decision deserved to be rewarded by another drink or two. He filled the jelly glass again, sat down in one of the kitchen chairs with its tubular steel legs, and lit a cigarette. And as he sat there, drinking and tapping curls of ash into one of the frozen dinner trays, he forgot about the foxtail and started thinking about Nettie Cobb. Crazy Nettie. He was going to play a trick on Crazy Nettie. Maybe next week. Maybe the week after that. But this week seemed the most likely. Mr. Gunn had told him he was a man who didn't like to waste time, and Hugh was willing to take his word for it. He looked forward to it. It would break up the monotony. He drank, he smoked, and when he finally passed out on the filthy sheets of the narrow bed in the other room at 9:45, he did it with a smile on his face. Wilma Jurczyk's shift at Hemp Hill's Market ended when the store closed at 7. She pulled into her own driveway at 7:15. Soft light spilled out through the drawn drapes across the living room window. She went in and sniffed. She could smell macaroni and cheese. Good enough, at least, so far. Pete was sprawled on the couch with his shoes off, watching Wheel of Fortune. The Portland Press Herald was in his lap. I read your note, he said, sitting up quickly and putting the paper aside. I put in the casserole. It'll be ready at 7:30. He looked at her with earnest and slightly anxious brown eyes. Like a dog with a strong urge to please, Pete Jurczyk had house-trained early and quite well. He had his lapses, but it had been a long time since she'd come in and found him lying on the couch with his shoes on, a longer one since he dared to light his pipe in the house, and it would be a snowy day in August when he took a piss without remembering to put the ring back down after he was through. Did you bring in the wash? An expression of mingled guilt and surprise troubled his round, open face. Geez, I was reading the newspaper and I forgot. I'll go right out. He was already fumbling for his shoes. Never mind, she said, starting for the kitchen. Wilma, I'll get them. Don't bother, she said sweetly. I wouldn't want you to leave your paper, or Vanna White, just because I've been on my feet behind a cash register for the last 6 hours. Sit right there, Peter. Enjoy yourself. She didn't have to look around and check his reaction. After 7 years of marriage, she honestly believed Peter Michael Jurczyk held no more surprises for her. His expression would be a mixture of hurt and weak chagrin. He would stand there for a few moments after she had gone out, looking like a man who just came out of the crapper and can't quite remember if he's wiped himself. And then he would go to work setting the table and dishing up the casserole. He would ask her many questions about her shift at the market, listen attentively to her answers, and not interrupt once with the details of his own day at Williams Brown, the large real estate agency in Oxford where he worked. Which was just fine as paint with Wilma, since she found real estate the world's most boring subject. After dinner, he would clear up without being asked, and she would read the paper. All of these services would be performed by him, because he had forgotten one minor chore. She didn't mind taking in the wash at all. In fact, she was fond of the feel and smell of clothes which had spent a happy afternoon drying in the sun. But she had no intention of letting Pete in on that. It was her little secret. She had many such secrets, and kept them all for the same reason. In a war, you held on to every advantage. Some nights, she would come home, and there might be an hour, or even 2 hours of skirmishing, before she was finally able to prod Peter into a full-scale retreat, replacing his white pins on her interior battle map with her red ones. Tonight, the engagement had been won less than 2 minutes after she stepped inside the door, and that was just fine with Wilma. She believed in her heart that marriage was a lifetime adventure in aggression, and in such a long campaign, where ultimately no prisoners could be taken, no quarter given, no patch of marital landscape left unscorched, such easy victories might eventually lose their savor. But that time had not yet come, and so she went out to the clotheslines with the basket under her left arm and her heart light beneath the swell of her bosom. She was halfway across the yard before coming to a puzzled stop. Where in hell were the sheets? She should have seen them easily, big rectangular white shapes floating in the dark, but they weren't there. They'd blown away? Ridiculous. There had been a breeze that afternoon, but hardly a gale. Had someone stolen them? Then a gust of wind kicked through the air, and she heard a large, lazy flapping sound. Okay, they were there. Somewhere. When you were the oldest daughter in a sprawling Catholic clan of 13 children, you knew what a sheet sounded like when it flapped on the line. But it still wasn't right, that sound. It was too heavy. Wilma took another step forward. Her face, which always wore the faintly shadowed look of a woman who expects trouble, darkened. Now she could see the sheets, or shapes that should have been the sheets. But they were dark. She took another, smaller step forward, and the breeze whisked through the yard again. The shapes flapped toward her this time, belling out, and before she could get her hand up, something heavy and slimy struck her. Something gooey splattered her cheeks. Something thick and soggy pressed against her. It was almost as if a cold, sticky hand were trying to grasp her. She was not a woman who cried out easily or often, but she cried out now and dropped the laundry basket. That soggy, flapping sound came again, and she tried to twist away from the shape looming before her. Her left ankle struck the wicker laundry basket, and she stumbled to one knee, missing a full-length tumble only by a combination of luck and quick reflexes. A heavy, wet thing slobbered its way up her back. Thick wetness drooled down the sides of her neck. Wilma cried out again and crawled away from the lines on her hands and knees. Some of her hair had escaped the kerchief she wore and hung against her cheeks, tickling. She hated that feeling, but she hated that drooling, clammy caress from the dark shape hung on her clothesline even more. The kitchen door banged open, and Pete's alarmed voice carried across the yard. "Wilma! Wilma, are you all right?" Flapping from behind her, a nasty sound like a chuckle from vocal cords clotted with dirt. In the next yard, the Haverhill's mutt began to bellow hysterically in its high, unpleasant voice, "Yark! Yark! Yark!" And this did nothing to improve Wilma's state of mind. She got to her feet and saw Pete cautiously descending the back steps. "Wilma, did you fall down?" "Yes!" she shouted furiously. "Yes, I fell down! Yes, I'm okay! Turn on the goddamn light!" "Did you hurt yourself? Just turn on the goddamn light!" she screamed at him, and rubbed a hand across the front of her coat. It came away covered with cold goo. She was now so angry she could see her own pulse as bright points of light before her eyes, and angriest of all at herself for being scared, even for a second. "Yark! Yark! Yark!" The goddamn mutt in the next yard was going ape. Christ, she hated dogs, especially the mouthy ones. Pete's shape retreated to the top of the kitchen steps. The door opened, his hand snaked inside, and then the floodlight came on, bathing the rear yard with bright light. Wilma looked down at herself and saw a wide swatch of dark brown across the front of her new fall coat. She wiped furiously at her face, held out her hand, and saw it had also turned brown. She could feel a slow, syrupy trickle running down the middle of her back. Mud! She was stupefied with disbelief. So much so that she was unaware that she had spoken aloud. Who could have done this to her? Who would have dared?
What did you say, honey? Pete asked. He had been coming toward her. Now he stopped a prudent distance away. Wilma's face was working in a way Pete Jerzyk found extremely alarming. It was as if a nest of baby snakes had hatched just beneath her skin.
Mud!
She screamed, holding her hands out toward him, at him. Flecks of brown flew from her fingertips.
Mud, I say! Mud!
Pete looked past her, finally understanding. His mouth dropped open. Wilma whirled in the direction of his gaze. The floodlight mounted above the kitchen door and lit the clotheslines in the garden with merciless clarity, revealing everything that needed to be revealed.